Yeah.
Awesome. Great.
We're thrilled.
So, good afternoon, everybody. We'll find a chair. You can grab chairs from the kitchen, too, and we can put them in here. Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to the Berkman Center for our Tuesday Luncheon Series. We're so glad to have both Sophie Hood and Helen Nissenbaum join us today to talk about information flows and online court records. So before we get started, if you have not been here before, just a couple of quick announcements. One is that we are recording this, but not webcasting this talk. So please just be aware that the talk may be posted online at some point to the Berkman Center website. And so there are microphones all around the room and recording comments. So please just be aware of that. The second is that there are trash cans right outside if you're looking for them after the end of the talk. So please be sure to utilize them afterwards. And the third is just so that we can all get a sense of who is in the room today. We often do very brief introductions. I'll start and then we'll just go around the room after that. So my name is Omer Asher. I'm on staff here at the Berkman Center.
John Hawkinson, I'm a freelance news reporter.
And we're a computer programmer.
And I'm Todd Boone, I'm a retired librarian and IT manager.
Emily Anderson, I work for the Harvard Library Office for Scholarly Communication.
Alicia Sola-Niederman, I'm a project manager here at Berkman.
I'm Davida Maria Benfield, I'm a Berkman fellow.
I'm Longjun Guo, I'm Berkman in Freedom of Expression team.
Kiske Otsubo, I'm also an intern student and I'm on the Berkman Center project.
If you could just speak up because these projectors are very loud, that would be great.
I'm Deborah. I'm visiting C Lab at MIT.
I live from Tokyo, Japan. I was a postdoc in Japanese studies at Harvard, and now I'm a professor for the.
I'm Ethan Katch. I run the Center for Technology and Dispute Resolution at the University of Massachusetts.
I'm Dustin Luce. I'm the HGO and PLOW project manager at the Berkman Center and the Humboldt Library.
I'm Mary McCrossin. I'm the Media
Team. I'm Sean Thomas. I'm the Research Associate at Harvard.
I'm an intern here on the
I'm Thomas. I'm an intern.
David O'Brien, Berkman Center.
Levet Moore from Cambodia, the court interpreter.
I'm Jesse, and I'm an RA.
Chris Amico, I'm a program and journalist.
Laura Amico, founder of Homicide Watch, criminal justice reporter, and Berkman Fellow.
Florian Seismist, researcher from Hamburg, Germany.
I'm Joseph Riegel from Northeastern.
I'm Linda Kinsler from Union Lab.
I'm Christopher, I'm a business consultant.
Is this, are you here because of the free lunch? It's so great, it's awesome.
Do we want to go around the table?
Sandy Singer, I'm a local lawyer.
I'm Drew Mill, I'm an intern for Media Cloud team here.
I'm Tom, and I'm a Cyber Law Clinic intern.
David Larchell, Berkman Center.
Megan Larkham, intern at Berkman.
Meghna Khandika, also an intern.
Priya Kumar, intern on the Freedom of Expression team.
Liz Woolery, intern on the Chilling Effects project.
Samantha Scheller, intern for Digital Media Law Project.
Rebecca, intern for the Digital Media Law Project and a law student.
Olivia Canetta, intern for Media Cloud.
Sanna Kulevska, Swedish law student, intern on the Chilling Effects team.
Kelly O'Neill, law student, intern on the Privacy Tools team.
Rachel Loka, intern on Privacy Tools and working in the clinic.
Great, so what a terrific crowd, and definitely speaking to how interested folks are in this topic. So glad to have both Sophie and Helen here. So Sophie Hood is a research fellow at the Information Law Institute at NYU in the Department of Media, Culture, and Communication. And Helen Nissenbaum is a professor and the director of the Information Law Institute and a professor of Media, Culture, Communication, and Computer Science at New York University. And we're so glad to have you guys. So welcome.
Thank you. Well, first of all, thank you so much to the Berkman Center for having us, and a special thanks to Omer, Carrie, Furs, Mary, everybody who's helped welcome us here, and huge thanks to all of you for coming out. Helen, I don't know if you want to say a few words of introduction before we launch right in.
No, I just want to know if you can hear us back there, because we couldn't hear you. No. Yeah.
Okay.
You speak.
Is this
Is that a mic?
Is this on? Yeah.
The mic is just for the recording.
Oh, okay.
And this also just...
Okay, we will just project in that case. Did you want to... Great.
It's just great to see the kind of depth of expertise in this room. It's great. Thank you.
Certainly is. So without further ado, we wanted to begin by trying to give you all an overall sense of our objective with this project and also orient you to specifically what we're talking about. So this is work in progress, and the basic idea is to think through whether or not it's possible to develop tools with which one could enhance both privacy and transparency in online court records. And so we're working on a case study with those at Princeton's CITP who have done the RECAP project, which, as it sounded from conversation before we began, that many of you are familiar with that project. And we wanted to start with illustration by way of a quick example, which is bankruptcy court records. So it used to be the case that when you were interested in finding records of a bankruptcy case, you would need to physically go to a courthouse. So I just pulled here an image of the Northern District of California Bankruptcy Court. But these days, as many of you know, you may access bankruptcy court records online via the federal court system's record system called PACER, Public Access to Court Electronic Records. And as you are probably not surprised to know, you can find a wealth of documents that are very information rich, including very sensitive financial information. So I redacted these documents myself because I was quite uncomfortable including such information as assets, liabilities, home address, social security number, and the like. But if you're willing to pay 10 cents a page, you can simply log on and find that. So our question is whether or not one might develop tools to automatically determine with more granular rules what one is able to see when you go online or not. And I've put up here a sample docket. This is from the same bankruptcy case and RECAP, which, as many of you know, started as a project to free federal court electronic records, that is to take them out from behind the paywall. So you don't have to log into PACER, pay 10 cents per page, and the like. Rather, you can just go to the RECAP archive and download those documents. So that's sort of the big picture of what we're hoping to think through and to develop with our work. So in analyzing this issue, we are And today what we'll talk about is a bit about the background and theory of court records, their ultimate reason for being, as it were, and then a bit of the previous work that Helen and others have done with respect to contextual integrity and how it applies in this specific context. And then we'll get into a bit more detail about the case study that we're working on, and finally talk about our overall objectives. So, background and theory, this is the big picture stuff. A court record, since maybe we shouldn't take for granted what the definition is that we're working here, is the official report of the proceedings in a case, including the filed papers, a verbatim transcript of the trial or hearing, if any, and tangible exhibits. So that's quite broad. And in thinking about the purpose, most fundamentally, it's a collection of documents that aid in dispute resolution. And they're quite information rich. And they also produce a record that is then available to appellate courts should they be reviewing that case. So that's sort of the first order purpose of court records. But more broadly, they have many other purposes. Perhaps the one that is most commonly discussed being that of publicity, or what we might say today, transparency. And there are many underlying values that relate to publicity. I'll talk a little bit also about judicial independence and privacy and some of the associated values there. So a few words about publicity. This is one of my favorite quotes about publicity. from Jeremy Bentham in the early to mid 19th century, that publicity is the very soul of justice. And Bentham was certainly not alone in singing the praises of the virtues of publicity when it comes to the administration of courts. I won't read this entire quote by then Chief Justice of the Massachusetts Supreme Court, since we are in Massachusetts here today. But publicity has long been considered a very, very important value of courts and their functioning. But I think it's important to note that publicity is not traditionally conceived of as an end unto itself. Rather, it relates to other important values. So Bentham, when he was spelling this out, noted the significance of publicity with respect to sort of ferreting out the truth, its role in fact-finding, civic and moral education, and the notion of discipline. So you'll see that in this quote here, that publicity keeps the judge himself while trying under trial. And that's related to this concept of discipline. And of course, we can all appreciate this fun little image of the panopticon, which bears on discipline and all of these concepts. More recently, many scholars, including Judith Resnick and Denny Curtis, who have also written a lot about Bentham's writing in this area, have conceived of the importance of publicity in broader terms and its relationship to the very pillars of democratic self-governance. So in that respect, there's much more at stake with publicity and access to courts. Of course, many have acknowledged that at some point publicity must yield to other important interests, such as privacy interests. So again, even Bentham thought that at times publicity should yield to protecting people from annoyance, avoiding embarrassment or unnecessary harm, public decency, state secrets. And much of that might sound familiar in thinking about contemporary justifications for closing access to particular proceedings, which we'll get to. And today, as well, privacy interests are again conceived of more broadly. When you do not allow access, you may prevent stigma in a criminal proceeding that might foster rehabilitation. You protect witnesses and other vulnerable persons, and you maintain the dignity of some individuals who may be involved, and indeed the very proceedings. And again, as I just mentioned, national security or trade secrets and other proprietary information, these are all traditionally accepted reasons to curtail access or publicity. I did want to note with respect to judicial independence, and Judith Resnick and Denny Curtis have also pointed this out, that some of these values are in tension with one another. So we might say that we would like court proceedings to be very public and that we would like to subject judges to publicity. We saw that also in the Bentham quote, but it bears noting that that's in some tension with the notion of judicial independence. The idea being that if you're to scrutinize and discipline the behavior or the decision-making of any particular judge, they may not have the requisite independence to do what they think is particularly important or correct in that situation. So quickly, we're going to talk a bit about the legal framework here for access to court records. And I want to note at the outset of this area that I'm not going to be delving into the nooks and crannies of all the doctrine here, but rather trying to talk about some of the purposes and values, which is what Helen and I are most interested in for our work with Anupam, Data, and others. So I put up some of the text of the First and Sixth Amendments here, not necessarily for the text, but for what's not in the text. Note that there's nothing specifically about access to court records, although there are some important principles and structures that suggest some of the values we've been talking about, including publicity. So basically, the formalized notion of public access to court records is of a more recent vintage than many might suppose, if we're talking about specific articulations in case law. And one noteworthy transition occurred from 1979 to 1980 in the Supreme Court, where first the court decided that that the constitutional guarantee of public trial was personal to the accused and thus denied a newspaper company access. But then the very next year acknowledged that the access right is actually implicit in the guarantees of the First Amendment. And in undergoing that analysis, the court drew upon the history of the common law and the rich tradition of public access to trials, as long as sort of the penumbra, if we want to use that loaded term, of the First Amendment, the common core purpose of it, and indeed the structural role of free speech in our democratic society. Subsequently, the access right was expanded and solidified. Again, the rationales that we see are rooted both in the tradition of the common law and also the oversight function of it. Fairness is very important. The idea is that publicity and access both enhances fairness and also the appearance of fairness and thus confidence in the judicial system. I do want to note that there's a distinction between access to records versus access to proceedings. Perhaps the most commonly cited case on access to records is Nixon v. Warner Communications, which recognized this general right to access records, to inspect and copy them. Though it also bears noting here that this decision turned on a statute, on the Video Recordings Act. This case was about the press's access to Nixon tapes. And so although the court talks about access to records, it doesn't, this discussion about the common law access right doesn't ultimately bear on the outcome of the case, at least not directly. But the court does explain there that this right is not absolute, that it yields to other purposes, and that one shouldn't be able to access court records and use them for improper purposes. This may sound somewhat familiar to Bentham's explanation of poor reasons to be able to access a court record. So the last thing I'll note on this is basically just that the court there declined to delineate precisely the contours of this common law access right, but rather said that there needs to be balancing between the public interest and the private interest, and that really it's a decision best left to the trial court, and that a lot of deference will be afforded their decisions. And this results in a variety of tests and some difference in narrow courts and how it's handled. The last case law point, and this actually comes from a FOIA case, but it bears very much on our work on court records, which is just that there is acknowledgement by the Supreme Court that aggregation and medium does matter. So many of you are probably familiar with this Reporters Committee case. And as you can see here, the court has acknowledged that there is a big difference between looking at a compiled document that's chock-a-block full of quote-unquote sensitive information than in having to go around to different sources. And also that there's a difference in accessing a document that bears on the functioning of the government than a document that is simply a collection of very again, I'm loath to use the term, but sensitive information about a particular person. So pausing there, that was our overall framework, taking a look at some of the purposes and values of court records and also the current case law, even though, as you may have noted, those cases were not particularly recent and the law in this area is a bit unsettled. Now I want to talk briefly about some of the work that Helen and others have done with respect to contextual integrity in this concept. It's a theory that many of you may be familiar with. But to get there, we have to talk a little bit about the transition from paper to electronic records, which I previewed at the beginning with the bankruptcy court example. But essentially, courts started to use electronic records as early as the 70s, but by the 90s, this had really picked up steam. And in keeping with the decentralization I noted a moment ago, there is incredible diversity in the type of information systems that are in use here. And of course, when records are available online, that radically alters the ease with which they can be aggregated, searched, retained, indexed, all of that. And many have noticed that this development, as Peter Martin put it in 2008, is startlingly new and rich with implications. In response to this development, some have called for more publicity and others have called for more privacy. So some suggest that it would be a fantastic idea if we could go even further and search by judge or by attorney to assess the particular outcomes of cases. Others have noted that there has been a troubling trend of secrecy and they would like to see far more transparency. And we're gonna talk more about Steve Schultz and his and others' work at Recap, but some would like to make court records completely free, no paywall, accessible to anyone. And others have noted that it's far easier to find these information-rich documents and that there are many privacy interests at stake. So as we note here, Peter Wynn has argued that the balance shifted away from individual privacy and produced little, if any, benefit on the side of judicial accountability. So those are the sort of normative takes on it. I think as a positive matter, there seems to be less of both publicity and privacy. There have been shifts toward alternative dispute resolution and other less transparent, more secretive means of conflict resolution. There has been an increase in the use of blanket protective orders. And there also seems to be less privacy. As we saw at the beginning, it's very easy to go on to Pacer and find even somebody's bank statement if they've been in a bankruptcy proceeding. So previously, actually just last year in the Maryland Law Review, Helen, along with Anupam Datta, who's at Carnegie Mellon University, and Amanda Conley, Divya Sharma, published sort of phase one of this ongoing work on online court records, which was a study and an article that looked at this transition to online court records. And primarily, it was looking at federal electronic records a bit and also at New Jersey state court records.
We were focusing on the state record, the state court environment, because PACER had already, you know, PACER's already very far along in development. And but many courts are very much in the process of developing their systems of electronic filing and access to court records, and they have commissions and judges committees, and there's a lot of questioning about it. So we felt that we focused on New Jersey State as our main case, but we thought maybe here we could have some impact, and so we just accepted PACER and set it aside. But in this project, we're primarily, with Sophie, we're primarily focusing on PACER and, as we'll discuss, Recap as well.
Yeah. So that previous work was focusing on applying the theory of contextual integrity to the court records case. And so we've put up here some of the key concepts behind contextual integrity. But the essential idea is that one needs to develop appropriate flows of information. And so I don't know if you want to jump in and say anything else here. But so the primary findings of that piece were just that there had been a quite radical alteration in the costs of the ways in which these personal information flows as a consequence of the shift to online publication versus a physical local access system. And so if you think about some of the differences, you have the difference in the location of the information system, a laptop here versus a state court in New Jersey, the nature of the interface and how the records are indexed, the links between various information sources, access restrictions, the format of the records, and human factors, which also relates a bit to access restrictions. So it's quite a different experience to go to a court and talk to a clerk and go through a metal detector, give your ID, all of this to see a file and photocopy it, than it is to simply Google someone. So what that article didn't ultimately come down with any concrete recommendation, but it noted this radical difference and talked about a couple different alternatives by which you could guide information flow more carefully. So one option that was suggested was departing radically from the status quo and sanitizing records, both online and in person. So I think probably this presents various constitutional concerns and it wouldn't be tenable. Another possibility is a two-tiered alternative that would maintain the status quo in person at courthouses, but would sanitize a version for the open web, which doesn't present as many constitutional concerns, but data aggregators could still go to a courthouse and camp out there and compile lots of information. And it also may punt on a few tricky questions. So the third alternative model that I was particularly excited about when I read this earlier work was based on fine-grained differential access and whether it might be possible to vary access or the visibility of certain records based on the roles of the party requesting it, the roles of information subjects, the types of information, and the conditions under which that information is granted. So to give another sense, this is a slide which sort of summarizes some of the key parameters in developing contextual integrity, and you can imagine overlaying this into the court records context to think about various ways in which you could steer the flow. I don't know if you want to.
Yeah, I mean, I wanted to add something that maybe we set up the argument, but I'm going to just connect the dots.
Yeah,
which is that I have to say that. I'm confessing that my preferred option was the sanitizing the record, and then all my legal colleagues just shot me down and they said, this will never work, forget about it. Even though at the time I learned about some work at NYU in which there was a comparison done with, say, the Spanish court system, and it turns out that in some European countries, court proceedings are discussed, say, in public, the names, they're anonymized. Of course, my computer science friend said to me, it's impossible to anonymize, so forget about it. So I kind of accepted that option wasn't possible. But it wasn't a brute force idea that the way you protect privacy is just to withhold information. Part of the analysis of that paper that we're picking up in this project is to go back, and Sophie presented at the beginning of her talk the purposes of courts. Are you going to do more of that later on, or are we done with that? So, you
continue.
Know, what's the purpose of the justice system? You know, locate guilt and to resolve disputes and so on. And then what's the purpose of the court record within the court system? And some of it is transparency, some of it is to educate the public, some of it is to increase the efficiency or efficacy of those parties in the legal system, like the judges, the lawyers, and you know, you read these records too. So if you look at the court records and you're concerned about the information flows that may be problematic from a privacy point of view, you may be willing to accept those outcomes because you're concerned about this information promoting the ends, purposes, and values of the courts and of the functioning of court records within this larger court system. And you could even say the justice system of a nation, of a liberal democratic nation, where the courts are accountable to the values of our society. And so some of the reasoning we did at the end of that paper was to look at these alternatives and to say, can court records under these conditions where you're concerned about some of the the privacy issues or where you're concerned about imposing constraints on the flow of certain kinds of personal information, can you continue to promote these ends, purposes, and values of a court system while you're also, and maybe you can do it even better, and this is part of what we're saying, that you could promote the purposes of the court systems even better if you take care of privacy concerns that people may have in the court records. And so these solutions were attempts not just to block the personal information, but to do it in a way that was very mindful of the ends, purposes, and values of the particular court system. And what we figured is that if Bentham is right, and what you really care about, I mean, one of the concerns is a court system that's transparent and fair and unbiased, then the person who's scrutinizing the court record, we don't need to know the names of some of the parties. Maybe some of them, yes, but not certainly not all of them. Why do we need to know that? So and that's why we came to the solutions we came to. It wasn't just to cut the information off. And now, you know, in this next phase, we're trying to actually apply some of these ideas to show, because at times I would present this, I've presented it to, there's a annual conference on courts and technology, and people would come up to me afterwards and say, oh, that's all very well and good, but this is completely impractical, it's too complex, and so on. So what we're trying to do is develop these ideas further and also see if they can be applied to a specific case.
Absolutely. So, okay. No, that's fantastic. And just to expand on that a little bit, so one concrete example of a shift that might both enhance transparency and publicity, but also privacy, is rather than totally sealing a document, just selectively redact it, which may already be the ideal, but as a practical matter, clerks of court don't have the resources to do that. And so often things will just be treated in a binary manner, open or closed, sealed or not. Yeah.
So a lot of this presumes that the original court records are structured data. And so you could find the name of the person and it would be identified in some particular way. Is that true? Is the underlying data structured the way that you could select it and ask it?
Generally, no. And you are very prescient, we're about to get there. Generally, it's freeform PDF, and that's the very next slide. But basically, the idea is that the same technology that created this, if you want to call it a problem, could actually improve these systems, and there are efforts underway to structure the underlying data. So, for example, there's this movement toward adopting uniform legal XML standards, but right now, at least in the federal system, which is what we're focusing on, most of the documents tend to be unstructured PDF files. And that complicates this issue, but not unrelated to what Helen was mentioning with respect to her previous work with others on state courts. It also presents an opportunity for informing how these developments should occur in the future. So to the extent that ultimately the underlying documents will be more structured, we should think carefully about how they should be designed and how flows should work within them. We did want to note that we are cognizant of potential problems with this model, perhaps, of differential access. So it may well be the case that, particularly given recent developments, it would be viewed as running afoul of the First Amendment, basically, and that it's not permissible to differentiate access based on who is accessing that information or the reasons for their desire to access it. This is somewhat of an open question. So there was this previous case, Los Angeles Police Department case, in which LA decided they didn't want to release arrestee information to commercial companies that were then sending out mailings or whatnot based on this, but they only wanted to share the arrestee information with journalists, for example. And essentially, the Supreme Court said that was there was a facial attack, and the Supreme Court said that it couldn't be disposed of on overbreadth grounds. So as that case turned out, LA was able to place that use restriction, but it's not at all clear, particularly in light of Sorrell, whether or not you could use some type of a use restriction like that these days. Two quick answers to that. We wanted to note that part of what we're talking about with this new framework for access is that it could work on a couple different levels. So the low-hanging fruit is just to develop some sort of automated system that would work within extant rules. So there are already limitations, as we'll get to in a minute, on what is supposed to go onto PACER, but there are just mistakes all the time. So, and you've probably heard about Tim Lee's work on the number of times that there are social securities that are erroneously uploaded and the like. But we're more ambitious than that and would like to try to come up with some contextual integrity-based privacy rules that would do more than say, you need to redact social security numbers. And we also want to note that what we're talking about here is basically about shifting defaults when it comes to online publication. So just because it wouldn't be easy to go online and find somebody, that's not to say that it would be impossible to ever then view the underlying record. It's just about shifting the costs of disclosure. So getting a bit more concrete about our case study, we're interested specifically in federal court records and PACER and their privacy policy and whether or not we can use the RECAP archive and some of the fascinating challenges and developments they've faced as a window to think through some of these ideas and perhaps even develop a proof of concept or a demonstration. So a bit about PACER first. I'll go through this quickly because it sounded like a lot of you were familiar with PACER, but it's the Public Access to Electronic Courts Records System, and it's the public-facing version of the e-filing system for federal courts. It started in around 90, but it really got going in 98. It's large, 500 million case file documents, 1 million users. It used to be the case that the lion's share of their revenue came from, It used to be the case that the lion's share of the revenue came from commercial aggregators looking at bankruptcy records. And I couldn't find any updated data on this, but it's not only lawyers and well-meaning members of the public that are accessing all of these records. You have to pay a fee to access pages, but it's relatively minimal. And the access policy for the most part is that public is public. There's some very interesting history with respect to that from around 2000 to 2008. And there are particular struggles with criminal records and particular types of information. But basically, the decision that the courts made is that they were going to keep this public as public approach. And you can also access with PACER some statistical reports on the administration of the courts, which bears on publicity in one sense. Here is more or less the current policy for protecting private information. Some identifiers need to be removed, and it falls to the attorney or the person who's uploading the document to do that redaction or removal, and mistakes happen very frequently. And then, of course, there are the sealed cases. So a few issues with that. First of all, as you just saw, what one needs to redact is relatively de minimis, so home addresses, but in a criminal case. If you're in a civil case, home addresses are fine. And a lot of people, well, not a lot of people, but there are, of course, pro se litigants who do not have an attorney. There may be some repercussions for attorney error. I perhaps put that too strongly. But there isn't, for example, an ethical rule that requires this. And again, the frequency with which things are mistakenly uploaded is quite high. RECAP is an effort to take the PACER documents out from behind the paywall, as we discussed a little bit at the beginning. So in that sense, as you see, their motto is to turn PACER around. As you'll note, it's the acronym backwards. And the idea is just to bolster transparency and access. They've been tremendously successful. And as the size of the archive grew, the administrators became increasingly concerned with privacy issues, which they have been sensitive to all along, but it became more and more of a pressing issue. So eventually they disallowed search engine indexing of the documents that they had in the archive. And in a really, I think, interesting and exciting development, they automatically scan all the documents for social security numbers before they upload it. And they also invite users to report problems. As it turns out, they've been getting more and more complaints, basically. And I'm quite sympathetic because that presents quite an administrative hurdle. So now they are trying to think through what should be done when they receive a privacy complaint. And they have started to, and they take down certain documents about which they receive complaints. And this is interesting, we think, because the ultimate result of that is that you may be able to access a document on PACER, which you may not be able to access on RECAP. And so we're wondering if there might be a way to come up with further privacy tools to build upon the great privacy tools that they have already developed, such as the automatic social security number prevention of upload, and tweak the policy slightly to enhance privacy and transparency. So a colleague of ours joked that we should come up with a new acronym, not PACER, not RECAP, but maybe, well, I don't know. I put up a few different possibilities here. And whether or not it wouldn't be possible to come up with more granular rules so that for RECAP, they wouldn't have to automatically take down a document or an entire docket, but just selectively remove that information which is most problematic. And ultimately, maybe this will serve as a proof of concept for even PACER as they continue to improve their systems. So what we're hoping to develop, for starters, because we're really excited to be working with the CITP, and they have shared with us some of the complaints that they've received. So we're interested in cases where there has been a perceived privacy concern with a publicly available record, and whether or not we can develop a framework by which you could more carefully constrain information flows. So again, bookending and back to the bankruptcy example, many of the current uses of bankruptcy examples online may not fit as squarely with the values we spoke about at the beginning of the talk as clearly as one might think. So if it is the case that there's publicity and that you can go and look at bankruptcy records, but that most of the access to those documents is by commercial aggregators who are then reselling that information, it's worth thinking about that and whether or not that aligns as well with the democratic values for which the document is open and accessible in the first place or not. And again, there might be some simple fixes with respect to the formatting. So maybe we should adopt different standards, and that would allow us to tag and index these documents more carefully, prevent the proliferation of home addresses, whatever it might be. So it may just be that one could redact, as I have clumsily done here, but still boost many of the reasons for publicity in the first place. So fact-finding, protecting the integrity of the system, allowing people to democratically engage with courts. Another note is that if less documents were sealed, you could also get better aggregated data, which would shed light on the functioning of the system. So again, going back to this slide here, it may be that we want to think through information type, so maybe case type, but maybe more granularly the types of information within a particular document, the subject of the data, who's sending, who's receiving, what constraints it's operating under. And so with that, just a recap, if you'll pardon the pun, of what we've talked about, the underlying values here in this context are sweeping and sometimes in tension. So you can really, you can talk about privacy or publicity and craft arguments that would suggest that documents should be open or closed. But we really want to get beyond that binary and think through whether or not you can develop technological tools that would enable both. The law is not totally, is not that clearly established here, and the policy is a bit in flux as courts continue to develop these systems. So we're hoping, as we said, now that we have these materials, to come up with some paradigmatic cases and some machine implementable rules that could help with that. But we are so eager to hear your thoughts on this work in progress, and we would really welcome and appreciate any thoughts you might have about how we go from here. So, and I don't know if you have more to...
The speeding ticket guy, particularly not wanting to.
Well, it's up to you.
No, go ahead.
Well, so to give a sense of a few other potential examples, we talked about bankruptcy. There are a few other cases that might serve as jumping off points. Recap received a privacy complaint from someone who happened to be driving on federal land when they got a DUI. And as a consequence, there's a federal record of that. Usually a DUI would be in state court. And it was quite old. It happened maybe 15 or 20 years ago. But this was very frustrating for this particular individual because it was so readily accessible online. So I don't know where it happened. Let's say it happened when he was driving cross country and it happened in South Dakota. And 15 years ago, nobody ever would have been able to find that. But now it pops up. So that example illustrates this difference between the practical obscurity of a paper record versus the ubiquity of an electronic record and the ease of accessibility and whatnot. So the question is, should that be published online? And if so, how? Should it be visible to anyone? Should it be searchable? The like. So that's another type of example that we're thinking through.
Thank you guys for a really, really terrific presentation.
Thank you.
Which is fascinating. I deal primarily with criminal courts in Washington, D.C. Uh-huh. Terrific system that I'm very appreciative of. You can access the docket, on your computer wherever you are. If you want a document associated with the case, you go to the courthouse and you can print it out. You bring your paper, it's really simple. I cover entirely homicide cases, murder cases. And deal with a lot of the documents associated with those. And witness safety, of course, is always a huge concern. I practice open notebook journalism, mm-hmm. which means that we put all of our source material that is, you know, reasonably open to the public online, and that includes the documents. I do redactions of social security numbers, home addresses, phone numbers, those sorts of things. The interesting thing is that I've heard from detectives that they now write those documents differently because they realize that they're going to be online.
Yeah.
And I wonder if you could speak briefly about what reasonable education or conversation can be done sort of at a low level that respects privacy but creates documents that are, in fact, really reasonably open to the public.
Yeah. That is a great point and question. Thank you so much for bringing it up. And actually, that's another important example that we're hoping to get to with this work, because the RECAP administrators have received complaints from informants in a criminal case. And of course, that's particularly tricky because sometimes even a docket entry can indicate cooperation or some such thing that could then put someone at risk. And of course, given the very high stakes, you would want to err on the side of caution. I think that, and I don't know if this is going to answer your question directly enough, and Helen may have thoughts as well, but this problem of people modifying their behavior because they know the document could end up online, detects it, is pressing and makes all of this work all the more urgent. I know that there's been...
It's surely a problem, though. It may be a good thing.
Well, may be a good thing. I mean, there's this... Some of you may have heard of this website, whosetherat.com. I can send you some interesting articles on it, but there are now sites, for example, whosetherat.com, where people use these repositories of court records to try to determine rats or whatnot. And one response by law enforcement has been, as you say, to modify even what's in particular agreements. So I'm not sure that education, to the extent that education could help with that, I think that the underlying policy needs to shift to prevent the root cause of that problem. Because if there's a sense, for example, on the part of law enforcement officials or attorneys, that they are putting someone in danger by entering something into a document or putting it on the docket, I'm not sure education is going to prevent them from modifying their behavior. I think we have to protect the information more carefully and try to root out the cause. But I don't know, Helen, if you have.
Yeah, I mean, just adding to that. First of all, one thing that your point brings up is that initially, again, when we present this idea that we're going to change access principles to various fields of data in the court record, a lot of people who are very much in favor of transparency say, "Oh no, you know, I want to know if my neighbor is a sex offender. It's really about." But Peter Wynn, who's written a lot about this, and I think in our own thinking, we realize, but a lot of the information, when I say personal information, I just mean information about an identifiable person. A lot of that information is not about the direct parties to the case, but there are many other individuals who get involved in a case as witnesses and expert, you know, in different ways. And even jurors, we called up the New Jersey State Courts and say, what's your policy on including the names and information about members of a jury? And I have yet to find one person who can answer that question. It's kind of arbitrary. So now you might have the names and addresses of members of the jury, and there's no lawyer who's going to go into that document and strike these. And so we're concerned about all that information that's in there. So that's one point. But the other point is that, and this is sort of, if the detectives recognize that there's this flow that goes now online public access, and they start adjusting what goes in, I actually am reminded of a conversation that I've had with medical practitioners who say there's certain kinds of information that is very harmful to someone for purposes of getting health insurance. And so in anticipation of this problematic flow of information, medical practitioners will not write certain information into a record. Now, my question is, that's a terrible thing, because your record should have everything that's relevant to your health. But the practitioners are doing it for a very good reason and in your interest, so that you don't lose your insurance. So what kind of a situation are we in when our system forces those people who are creating the record from putting the best information into that record? Let's rather work on a system that that imposes much more intelligent access requirements onto those records. You know what I could do? I don't know your names, but I could kind of mark the fact that you raised your hand and go in an order so you don't have to keep on. So one, and two, three, four, and five, six. Can you remember your numbers?
My question is, if you set up the system and say all the court records went into a similar file format so you could go through and redact it, well, I guess it's two parts. One, I mean, are you relying on kind of this voluntary the courts voluntarily designed to do this? Are you relying on states coming up with laws, or are you relying on there? And second, it seems like it would help cases going forward, but for any cases that had at some point been online, I mean, isn't the cat already out of the bag?
Those are both great questions. And with respect to the first, as a practical matter, this is incredibly thorny, and implementing it will be very, very challenging. Because, as you note, we haven't even really dealt much with state courts in this work. With federal courts, there's some uniformity and centralization, but even PACER primarily deals with administrative things, and different jurisdictions have control over many of their own document systems. So the short answer, I think, would be that yes, we would be relying on some courts to adopt these policy changes. But the broader point, and Helen alluded to this a bit yesterday, is that theoretically, this issue of court records and online publication is something that many different jurisdictions are struggling with, including internationally. So we were on a call yesterday with a law professor in Brazil who is trying to think about how to balance this and whether or not he might be able to, whether we can work together to think about tools that he can implement in one of his databases, Ivar Hartman. So I think we would be happy if we were to come up with some sort of proof of concept that could show how this might work in practice and could be applied, for starters, to federal court records. And then with respect to old records, you're right. That would be a tricky question, and they would still be in an old format, and I don't know how it would be. I don't know how that would work. Got to start somewhere, I guess.
Two.
Okay. So one of the emerging and I think exciting areas in terms of holding courts accountable and understanding them is empirical legal studies, where you're actually doing statistical analysis of how these courts actually function. And how do you think you can sort of balance privacy with the need to give researchers and journalists these data sets to make these correlations across cases where no one individual case is particularly important, but the aggregate results could be very interesting and enlightening?
So in fact, the guy in Brazil, who I believe actually spent some time at Berkman, that's his primary project, is to provide statistical aggregate data to the courts, and it's working with the Supreme Court in particular. So, and we think that those activities are kind of our friend, because that effort is to go into the court documents and figure out how to structure the data in the court documents in order to do the kind of aggregate analysis that you're suggesting. That we all, you know, big data, blah, 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 we're going to get knowledge from all this massive data. But when that initiative to structure the data, we're saying, that's great, now let's give you a few, make sure that these parameters are in there too, so that when we design these rules, we've structured the data so that we can implement the access rules as well. Now, all the stuff about, you know, the difficulties of anonymizing and, you know, those problems hopefully will be solved by other people, like you'll solve that for us, right? So it doesn't get around those issues, but we hope that, I don't know,
your addresses, well, it's probably not something you want public. On the other hand, I could imagine some very interesting analysis of, you know, zip codes of jurors and likelihood of convicting, you know, just to throw something like that out there.
Yeah.
I think that it's the question of how this all fits in with empirical legal studies is a very good one and a really fascinating one. So thank you for bringing that up. I think it bears particularly on the first part of our conversation and thinking about the underlying values and the reason why we have public access to records. So speaking a bit about, you know, some work that Peter Martin and Linda Pucky has done, there have been calls for way more transparency and, in fact, small adjustments to PACER, such as being able to search by judge or by attorney, by litigant, that sort of thing. And you can imagine, of course, the upside to that. It would be quite fascinating. And there are some private efforts. So there's Lex Machina, which does, you know, has a repository of IP cases, who, as I understand it, can do that kind of analytics. But thinking about it a little bit more, do we really want to be able to look at the decisions of a particular judge and easily have members of the public access those analytics? Maybe, but it may also be that infringes on judicial independence. Now, that's not a huge deal. I mean, it may be a huge deal in Article III federal courts, but it would be an even bigger deal for state-elected judges who have to campaign. So it's not, we don't think, a foregone conclusion that the more public, the better. We think that there are these values that are sometimes in tension and conflict. So I guess the short answer is we're thinking about it and we're not quite sure, but that's another reason why we're interested in working with Ivar Hartman in Brazil about how it might bear.
I think that this really gets into the deep, I think, philosophical questions about the purposes of the courts. And in New Jersey, they had a commission that ran for a couple of years deciding what the rules should be. And there was a lot of infighting, and a lot of the data was being sold to data aggregators to do profiling and onward, as I'm sure you're all familiar. So what my response was to say, courts should be producing information and providing access in order to promote the values of the court. It's not the business of a court to create a repository of personal information that can provide input into whether a company should hire someone. I mean, you may think that if someone's committed a crime, they should be responsible and so forth, but the question is, what are the court documents for? And once we answer that question, that's going to direct. So you might say, oh, we can get a lot of knowledge if we just do all this analysis. But if it doesn't serve the purposes of the courts, I say no. And when you look at the argumentation in that commission, there was a rather kind of deep cleave between those who felt that court documents can be doing all the social work beyond promotion of the functioning of the courts. Okay, sorry, we went on for a while. Should we take two questions at a time so that we can get through? So three and four. Who was three and four? Okay.
Relates to the second option that you talked about, with the status quo being, or keeping court documents as the status quo, but then redacting them online. And it gets at the idea of, are these two different pieces of information when they appear on paper compared to online? And the question comes from, I was captivated by the gun map that the Journal News created back in January, where they took public records of gun licenses and then made a Google map that was interactive, and people exploded because they said this is a violation of privacy, even though those records were always public, you could always look at them, but suddenly, now that they're all aggregated on a map, people felt like they were different. And so I'm interested to hear, from your perspective, have you seen in your research anything to suggest that it is actually, you're dealing with two different pieces of information when you have a record on paper and a record online?
As you kind of guessed, David's question relates very much to what I was thinking about during your presentation, and more or less answered the question I was going to ask. So I'll just turn it into a comment following up on David's. This question of how you draw the distinction between aggregate statistical analysis and the kind of thing a search engine might be able to do and hone on an individual's information is exactly the sort of thing that this line of work on differential privacy I'm familiar with is designed to try and separate these, be able to give you a way to separate these things. Now, as you also know, that there are still a lot of questions about how practical it can be. But once you figure out what kinds of statistical analyses are part of the purpose of court records, there may be tools that can handle that and get away from the anonymization problem. So I'll use the opportunity to actually ask another just small question, is whether you can, the whole presentation was fascinating here to see the way in which privacy comes in such stark tension with the other values here. I was wondering if you can give just a few more examples of the differing contexts that you have in mind, beyond kind of within the courts and outside the courts, But what are some of the more examples of different contexts in which you might make different decisions about what kind of information to share?
Great. Well, those are both fantastic questions and comments. Thank you so much. Going in order with respect to the first, I am not a philosopher by training. I'll leave that to Helen. But I would say that the information is the same, but it is radically altered by these novel ways in which it flows. I was also really interested in the gun map incident. And I think that that is exactly what we're getting at here. When documents are published online, there is more access, but there's also more susceptibility for error. So there are all of these shifts along multiple dimensions, not least when you think about the passage of time, deletion, expungement, and the like. So I would say the information is the same, but what is at stake is different, dramatically so. I don't know if you have thoughts on the information differences, or if we should go to the next.
I remember, maybe go to the next,
okay.
And then I'll...
Yeah. And then in terms of more examples, thank you. It's a great question. It's interesting to think through, for example, how information flows in systems that are internal to the court versus external to the court. And already, PACER and CMECF has a system for access and different access levels. So if you're a clerk or a judge or working within the court, you'll have a different docket that will appear differently and which will be sort of simplistically color-coded to indicate that which is publicly available and that which isn't. But we think that there's a potential for more granularity and more differences based on who's accessing particular documents. So you could even imagine boosting security and privacy within a court by having particular clerks maybe not access absolutely everything. And then with respect to the public, it may be that you don't want, let's say, the juror names in the, well, perhaps it's not a good idea to delve into events that are so current, but in the George Zimmerman case, to be public. You may want them to be public eventually, after a certain amount of time has passed. You may want ZIP plus 4, as was suggested, eventually. But you can imagine more granular rules, multiple types of granular rules, based on all of the different parameters in contextual integrity that would allow for differences based on who's accessing, why, the type of the information, all of that. So I don't know if that's helpful or if there might be more. Okay.
I mean, I wanted to get a little, just add a few comments. So to this question that if you go back to the history of social security numbers to the 1960s when social security numbers were introduced, and the rule was it's just for this purpose, you know, taxation. And now it became attached to everything else. So at that time, social security number was an unproblematic piece of information. Now we have all this headache of redacting social security number because it has a different significance. And I don't recall the exact, I remember seeing that gun map, but the idea here is that when information takes on new meanings and different meanings, especially as it's associated in clusters and so on. And so the rules, our contextual rules, these informational rules, are going to evolve over time. So it's not just the case that this information is sensitive and here's the rule for it. It's a constant evolving thing. And so now that we can take the information from gun ownership and, you know, display it on a map like this, we might decide, well, what purposes is this serving? Is it important? Blah, blah, blah. But if we decide it's problematic, we may need to go back and look at what it was in that initial information and say that this was okay before because it required going to each of these different records. Now we have the capacity. Therefore, we need to revisit what's the appropriate place to place constraint, and the constraint can be placed back to this idea on any of the parameters. It can be placed on who has access, under what conditions, and the nature of the information that you're constraining. Now, you know, your question about, I wasn't sure what your question was about asking about different contexts. This study is very specific to courts, and so we focused on the context of courts within the justice system and so on. Is that, so?
I guess I'm using it just in the sense that it's on this slide. Whether information within court records is visible in the court, for the example.
Because I'll tell you one of the really interesting, you know how you have something will happen and then that'll suddenly, so again, this was in New Jersey, and I have this friend, Grayson Barber, who was on the commission, and one of the examples was some guy was found guilty of some crime, but it was mistakenly listed as, I don't know, child kidnapping or something. And this was in his record, and this got picked up by one of the data brokers. And every time he tried to do anything, like get a job, they would go to the data brokers, and it showed that him to be a child kidnapper. And his life was a wreck. When he went to the data broker and said, he sued the data broker, the data broker said, I got this information from the courts. When he went to the courts, the courts said, okay, we've corrected the information. Meanwhile, the data broker still has that data. So the question is, if the courts are going to become repositories of personal information, they have to act very differently. You know, the system isn't set up for that, and that's sobering. Okay, so we should.
Yes, we should move on. I just want to jump in with one other quick question, which bears on this question about the type of information. And what Helen said about how these rules may evolve over time. And that is just to acknowledge that there is a danger here of a slippery slope when it comes to big data and data mining. So it could be that eventually analytics are so sophisticated that it matters whether you're wearing a blue blazer in court or some such thing. But I don't think any of us would say today that that should be redacted or not on the public record. So that's something to think through for the future.
Yeah. So I have 5, 6, and there might have been 7. So who's?
5, it's kind of a mega comment. My reporting deals with civil and criminal cases and not really with bankruptcy cases. And I think there is a pretty big difference. In civil and criminal cases, there's a lot of motions and briefs, and there's very little of lists and forms. So there are some. And I think what you're looking at mostly pertains to lists and forms. It's kind of hard to have structured information in a brief that can be 30 pages of argument. I don't know if you need a slightly different approach. You suggested sometimes that maybe the clerks don't have the resources to redact. I'd say they never do. It's really always the burden of the parties, and it should be pushed onto the parties. And you know, one answer that's often done is if you're not allowed to file a sealed version unless you also file a redacted version. Mm-hmm. Another category of information that we didn't really talk about, you might think about, is how transcripts are treated in PACER, where they have a 30-day hold. So you can't see them unless you physically go to the courthouse and look on the public terminal, unless you're the attorneys in the case, in which case you can look at them from your office, unless it's a case like the Bulger trial where I was this morning, where you can buy the case, you can buy the trial transcript from the court reporter like anyone can, and the Globe's buying it mostly every day and putting it on the web, so it's actually there. But in a normal case, at least, the trial transcripts are not available unless you wait or you go to the court and you actually look at it, you know, on their screen. A lot of what you have is about tagging the information in a structured way. And if you do that, I think that mostly solves your empirical legal studies question. I mean, in my simplistic view, you just have some court security officer who decides, is this a query we're going to let these people run according to whatever our rules are? And they say, yes, we'll run it for you and give you the answers, or no, we won't. And they update the rules, and it's kind of all good. In PACER, you can search by attorney. Also, with respect to this question of searching by judge, I would say, don't try to imagine a world where it won't happen. It's coming. It's especially coming for the cases for state elected judges. If the press hasn't gotten up our ass and made sure that we know the status of those people and what they've done and what their judicial records are, it's coming. So make sure your system, present a system where it's coming in a good way and where the information is manageable in a reasonable way and you can make reasonable decisions rather than assuming that it's kind of not going to happen. Because if you try to lock down the information, people will just, who have financial incentives to do so, will just go and get it somehow. Thanks. You had a response.
No, we do, but we'll wait.
We'll do two at a time.
We're going to wait until the time runs out.
We addressed some of the issues I was going to talk about, but I just wanted to thank you. And I used to direct a project called Open Court, which deals with a lot of the same issues that you guys are talking about. So it's really nice to hear this conversation continuing. I think you're at the crux of the problem is how everyone at the court is used to information being revealed and information that they give out is technically public, but it's been private by obscurity condition. And they just have no idea how to deal with that. I was going to ask some questions that have already been addressed, but what are the challenges to achieving that kind of standard machine-readable XML format for court information? And are you most excited about this sociological study ramifications for that? And where are the lines there?
Can you say more about the sociological? What do you mean by that?
Sure. Exactly. If you're saying the past 20 years, let's look at race or let's look at class issues. Fair game, I guess, in that
view. Yeah, that's a great, those are great questions. Starting with five,
it's very funny to have numbers for everyone. thank you, that's all very, very helpful. And those are all fantastic reminders. I agree with you that searching by judge is coming. I think it's here. It's just that right now it's maybe not integrated yet into the court systems themselves. It may be that other people are running those analytics. And you're right that the transcript delayed publication model is quite interesting. Sometimes something similar happens in discovery with respect to blanket protective orders that don't get removed until down the line. And I think your point is really fascinating about...
So indictments do that. Like right. They're sealed, initially before you can see the case at all, and then they
right,
pop
and
up.
Some, like, grand jury stuff never gets unsealed sometimes. But... We're also interested, you mentioned the differences between civil and criminal cases and how sometimes those records might be less amenable to structure. We're interested in particular ways in which that could shift in the future. So, there have been calls for more structured cover sheets to even dictate particular features of a case, which would assist in the statistical analyses that even PACER is doing already or the like. So. We're in some respects trying to zoom out and look in part at the current structure, but also in an ideal universe that may be some ways away, how would these things be structured? But those were wonderful comments. Thank you. And then great to hear about the Open Court project. In terms of what we're most excited about, I think that question of the potential for sociological study based on structured data bleeds back into this empirical legal studies issue in a really interesting way. And I'd say we're very excited about that, or I am very excited about that. I love ELS. But it's about how not to sacrifice privacy on the altar of ELS is what I would say. And as you mentioned, I think that court employees are particularly concerned about the prospect of closing down access because we all appreciate this publicity ideal so deeply. So I think that we're excited about coming up with some automated way by which we could try to have a bit of the best of both worlds.
And you think tiered access is like inevitably the best compromise? Or?
I wouldn't say there's anything inevitable about it, but in thinking through other alternatives, none of them seemed particularly tenable to me. I wouldn't quite call it tiered access.
No, it's just differential. It's differential access where all the parameters matter. Tiers suggest two tiers. And we're saying there could be multiple different rules where, that's all, multiple different rules based on the different parameters, and they all can vary
simultaneously.
And the last thing is about cost shifting and defaults. So it's not that necessarily things would be absolutely set in stone. So you might have this differential flow with multiple tiers, if we want to conceive of it that way. But it's not then to say that even if it were difficult for a member of the public to access something online or via a search, they couldn't then petition to have access to the underlying information.
I mean, I just, the main point that when I hear people say things like sacrifice, you know, I don't see privacy as sacrificing anything, because what the physician, what, say, the case of the physician really tells me is that information will flow best if it hearkens to a number of values to which we're committed. And if physicians, for example, or detectives are not filling out their forms true to the situation, then empirical studies are going to suffer. So there isn't really, I think in many instances, there is no trade-off with privacy. And in fact, adequate privacy is going to make our knowledge base better.
That is a fantastic last thought, I think. And we've been told we have to vacate this room now, more or less. But thank you so incredibly much for your attention. And we'll be here if people want to continue the conversation outside or whatnot. We'll be around for a few more minutes.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
A few more hours.
Yeah, you know, so I agree with you, by the way, about privacy. You're a private citizen. Now, the judges, if you're an elected judge, I mean, there's an issue of whether judges should be elected because of.
Right.
But the public has a right to know what they're voting on. But you can get that from Lexis. I mean, right now, for the judge's name in. You know, you can't do a pace of, but I mean, the public should know and